And if you want to be a part of the conversation too, then subscribe to my Patreon, www.patreon.com/Mr. Chaz, and join the conversation. Ask your own questions.
What's my name? What's my name? What's my name?
It's harder for the adult to learn and accept consequences than it is for the child, in my opinion, because we're the ones that want to make this muddy and problematic, right? Mm-hmm. But it's being able to recognize that I did something, I said something that affected another individual, and having that compassion of, I wish I would have done something different. And I think that we've all been in those scenarios where we've said something or we've done something, and then you realize that it wasn't the best thing to do, and you feel bad about it. Internally, you feel bad about it. Without anyone saying anything or provoking anything, you feel bad about what you've done or you've said. That's a natural consequence, and that's how we learn. That's the best way for us to learn, rather than it being a rule that is enforced or a punishment that is enforced. And so my advice to adults is to kind of simplify this. Don't make it so junky, right? But focus on those internal consequences of the feelings that you have about the choice that you made.
Welcome to Mr. Chaz's Leadership, Parenting, and Teaching Podcast, where I introduce you to the people that can help you on your leadership, parenting, or teaching journey. And today I've been really excited to have this conversation with this person. It's going to be another exciting conversation where there's going to be a lot of great nuggets of information. But before I continue talking about this person, I'm going to let him introduce himself.
Well, hello, Mr. Chaz. My name is Tim, Tim the Trainer, and I'm so excited to be here with you today. Hope everyone had a wonderful holiday weekend or holiday month. And you're ready to kickstart this new year. It's going to be a great year. I just feel it in my bones. It's going to be a great year.
Yeah. And we're going to make it a great year. So Tim, the trainer, who are you? What do you do? Who are you and what do you do? Because well, I know you wear lots of hats. So
Yeah. I don't do very much. My name is Timothy Smith. I live in Dallas, Fort Worth, Texas. I wear many, many hats. I own and operate 6 early education programs and after school programs here in North Texas. I've been working in the early education business for about 34 years now. I've owned my own schools going on 12 years. Something that we're very proud of, we're nationally accredited. We're a 4-star Texas Rising Star programs. We just love what we do. In addition to that, I am a trainer and a coach nationally. So I train at national conferences, symposiums, with a big focus on leadership and inspiration. I'm also a conscious discipline certified instructor, which I absolutely love. That's kind of my retirement plan right there. And in addition to all of that, I also am on the board of directors for the National Association for Early Learning Leaders. And basically, we are an organization that supports the leaders of early education programs through networking and professional development and collaboration. So that's just a tiny bit of what I do. And I just stay a little busy. I'm actually packing up right now as we speak, taking a break from packing. We leave tomorrow on our winter training cruise. So we do that 3 times a year where we do training and professional development on a cruise ship. So we have 130 people that are going to be cruising with us starting tomorrow, and we'll do 10 hours of professional development on the ship.
Wow, I need to come work for you because I'm working at a school right now and we do professional development. We work at the school for half a day and then we just stay at the school. I would love to have a 10-day cruise and get professional development. I love cruising. So I'll be sending you an application after this conversation. Let me throw just a question out there. If you had to choose one of those jobs that is closest to your heart or you're most passionate about or you is most fun for you, which one would you choose?
Well, that's not a really fair question because that's like asking a parent what is their favorite child.
Yeah.
You know? And you can't answer that question, who your favorite child is, because it also could depend on the day of the week and what that child did last night. And so, you know, as far as the different hats that I wear, it all depends on what day of the week it is and what's going on in the world. That's a really good question, though, and I would have to really think about that. I love the day-to-day operations of the school. I love the connections that we make with the parents, the connection with the community, you know, being able to see a child enroll in our infant program and then graduate out of the pre-K classroom and into the after-school program, especially families that have multiple children and we see them in stages. I love it. And of course, I have a big focus on leadership and professional development. So I love working with the teachers, growing the teachers, seeing them grow, seeing them, you know, obtain success. I just love that day-to-day operation of the schools. But on the other hand, the training side, the training and coaching and being able to travel all over the country, meeting other early educators, seeing other programs, I just absolutely love that too. And of course, my journey with Conscious Discipline has been so, so extraordinary. It has changed my life. It has changed our culture. It has changed the type of trainer I am. So again, it all depends on the day of the week on which one is closest to my heart.
Okay. Good diplomatic answer there, mm-hmm. Tim. But let me ask you a little bit more about, you said Conscious Discipline has changed your life. It changed, you know, your leadership. It's a really big statement to make. And I'm curious about that and curious as to first, how has Conscious Discipline impacted you in that way? Like, how could this social emotional program that we think about for children, how could mm-hmm. that change your adult life?
So, you know, Conscious Discipline is definitely a transformational journey. And, you know, anyone that is looking into this program or curious about it, that's like one of the biggest things that you've got to know is that it is a transformational journey. And one of the things that really hooked us when we first got introduced to Conscious Discipline and when we first started practicing within the schools is that it is an adult first, child second model. And you've got to put the focus on the adult first, and the adult has to be willing to practice new skills. And working in the industry as long as I have, and I am very, very blessed that I have a lot of very long-term, dedicated and passionate teachers that teach in our classrooms that have been doing this for 25, 30 plus years. Are they willing to practice new skills and try something new so that we can connect with the children and have that impact? And once we started this transformational journey and we were all on board and we were all willing to see things differently, it has changed, like I said, the culture of the school, like completely changed it, the way we lead, the way we connect, the way we interact with the community, the way we practice positive intent. And especially over the last 3 years, pushing through the pandemic like we've all done, practicing that power of acceptance, practicing that positive intent, has been a life changer. And I honestly don't know how we have made it or how we could have made it through the pandemic if it wasn't for, you know, those seven powers and seven skills of conscious adults. But just experiencing firsthand that transformation within the school with the adults has been probably one of the most impactful things in my career.
Okay. Got to dive in deeper into that, because you said once once you kind of had everyone's willingness, once everyone was willing to go on the journey of conscious discipline, was it just everyone was just kind of magically like, hey, this is conscious discipline, and everyone's like, okay, yeah, I'm willing to do it, and everyone raised their hand and everyone jumped to do it? I how did you get to that point where, you know, everyone was willing? What did that look like? And how was it used? You also, this is kind of a two-part question. And then how was it used in this, like the school during the, like you said, that you don't know how you would have gotten through it. Like, what about conscious discipline actually helped you as adults navigate this, that kind of like new challenge?
Sure. So first off, let me tell you, when we first got introduced to conscious discipline about 7 or 8 years ago now, myself and then three of my directors received a scholarship to attend CD1 in Orlando, and we went and fell in love with it. When we came back to introduce it into the schools and to start our CDAT team, we failed miserably. And, you know, and I love telling this story because it's a real story. We came back too strong, too aggressive. We didn't follow the process. The four of us, you know, were willing. We didn't give the others the opportunity to make that choice themselves. Mm. And we came in too aggressive and we failed miserably. We learned the hard way that we had to take a step back. We had to start over. So, you know, the second time we came to CD1, you know, the four of us came again, but we also brought four additional people. So there were eight of us that second time. We learned our lesson and we came back to the schools and we did it the right way, where we slowly started to introduce it. We slowly started practicing the skills and building that school family. Because we realized that even though the four of us got a taste of it and we were pumped up and we were excited to make this change, we had to get everyone else to make that choice themselves. That you can't force that choice onto someone. They have to be willing to practice something new. So that second time around, we came in like we're supposed to, small layers. And then slowly over the course of another year, year and a half, we got everyone to make that choice to be willing to practice new skills. At that point, and it was probably about a year, year and a half after that second trip to CD1, we were able to get the entire school family on board. And at that point in time, it blossomed. And it's been an amazing journey since that point. And when you're dealing with, you know, individuals that have been pre-K teachers for 30 plus years and they're good pre-K teachers, they don't want to change. They're not willing to change. And I openly had teachers tell me, I know what I'm doing. I'm good at what I do. I've been doing this for 30 plus years. I'm not doing it differently. And, you know, those are the ones that we had to get them to buy into this. Now, you know, and I've got several stories that I could tell, but we don't have 8 hours, you know, but they're some of the most amazing conscious discipline classrooms we have in our schools now.
Okay.
And they change too, as humans, you know, I can see the transformational change in them as well.
Yeah. Well, maybe you can just tell us one, because I'm curious about that year and a half of just like what you, because a lot of people are, you know, right now listening are either a parent or they're a teacher And, you know, they're bought into the idea and they're, you know, trying to practice conscious discipline or, you know, just more aware discipline with children. And they're working with someone who's not bought in, who's not willing. So if you can give us like a story or a tidbit of like of something that you did or tried in that kind of year and a half block that might have opened them up a little bit more to being willing to try to go on this transformational journey.
Yeah. So I kind of talk about this a lot whenever I do workshops on school-wide implementation of conscious discipline. But, you know, I had one particular pre-K teacher that was pretty stubborn in the fact that she wasn't going to change. She wasn't going to practice these skills. She absolutely was not interested. And when we made the decision company-wide to implement conscious discipline and actually adopt it into our policies, so basically practicing conscious discipline was no longer an option. If you wanted to work at our schools, it was required. And I had a conversation with my director at this particular location and said, hey, you know, just FYI, if we choose to adopt this into our policies, we're probably going to lose this one particular teacher. Because if she's not willing to practice new skills, then we're probably not going to be the best school for her to work at any longer. And we came up with the agreement that that was fine, that if we lost her, it was meant to be. But we went forward with it. Part of that process is I had Vicki Hepler, who is a master instructor with conscious discipline. Vicki came out and did an in-service day with us, with our entire company. And we went over school-wide implementation and the seven powers and seven skills and et cetera, et cetera. That one particular day, this one pre-K teacher, of course, was sitting there with her arms crossed, with the total disgust look on her face, you know, did not want to be there and was turning her nose up to everything Vicki had to say. And it was about halfway through the day when Vicki started talking about classroom chants and having a theme of your classroom and coming up with a classroom chant to establish that sense of safety, that sense of unity and connection. And we all kind of practiced doing classroom chants. That was the one thing that this teacher was kind of like, okay, well, I kind of like that. You know, she was like, I don't like the rest of it, but I like this part of it. That's all it took is, and now we focus on this so much with implementation. All you have to do is find one skill, one routine, one structure that calls out to that teacher that they can connect with. And once you can get them to connect to that one thing, the rest of it just starts flowing. And now, you know, you fast forward all these years later, that particular teacher has one of the best conscious discipline classrooms in our company. It is absolutely amazing. She's been to Orlando. She's been to CD1. And her transformation is so magical. And, you know, another big part of this is when we first started rolling this out and when we were in that building of the school family phase, we did a lot of parent workshops, and we still do a lot of parent workshops. That's something that we're really proud of in our organization. During COVID, we had to put a pause button on our parent workshops. And so we're just this past fall, we've started our parent workshops back up, and it's been so fantastic. But, you know, the same thing with the parent workshops. Now, with parent workshops, we do them very different than professional development for our teachers, because with parents, it's very small nuggets that are applicable to home and what they can do at home to complement what we're doing in the classroom. But there were a lot of families too, whether it's culture, whether it's the environment that they live in, there were a lot of families that were very hesitant on this process as well. So kind of bringing in those small layers and practicing the skills with the families, that was a huge part of our transformation too. And then we really quickly learned that our families are hungry for this as well. And they're wanting new skills that they can practice at home and new ways of doing things at home, kind of breaking that cycle of how we were raised as children and how our parents were raised by our grandparents. And the cycle just continues until someone is willing to break the cycle and try something new. And now this is kind of crazy, but we have to put a cap on our parent workshops because we have so many people that want to attend. And, you know, it's kind of on a first come, first served basis now, but it's fantastic. What a wonderful problem to have.
Yeah. Very powerful. Let me ask this on the, diving a little bit more into the parents. Are there any nuggets that, have you found in doing these parent workshops that parents tend to, or certain skills that parents really tend to gravitate towards more? Or when you know, when you bring this up, you start talking about it, it resonates with a lot of parents. Like, oh, I want to use that. And they want to learn more about that. Is there, what have you found to be kind of has resonated most with parents?
Probably one of the biggest aha moments that we've had with families that we receive the most feedback on, and parents are constantly telling us that they still are practicing this, is, you know, the mirror neurons and my state dictates your state, and that the adult has to be regulated before they can co-regulate a child. And you know, and also, you know, when we talk in conscious discipline about the way adults treat each other has a bigger impact on children's development of self-esteem than how the adult treats the child. That's critical right there. And because we're downloading that state, and all of us as parents, I've got two children myself, you know, we have that internal state and we get triggered as well. And we don't realize how much we download to our children. And so many of the behaviors that we get aggravated with our kids, you know, we got to look in the mirror and see that we're the ones downloading that. And that is like a critical moment for someone to realize, oh, I have to be willing to change myself first and recognize that I have to practice composure. I have to practice calm. I have to practice breathing before I can assist my child. And being consciously aware of your triggers is huge for the families. And we get feedback on that part of it so much, you know. And again, I did not start practicing conscious discipline until my children were older. And so, you know, my kids are 27 and 28 now. And I even went through this period of time where I had a lot of regret, and I said to myself quite often, I wish I would have had these skills back when I was a pre-K teacher and I was in a classroom. I could have been such a better teacher. I wish I would have had these skills when I was raising my two kids. I could have been such a better parent. They could have turned out so much better. Not that there's anything wrong with them now, but, you know, I could have definitely done things differently and better. Every parent's going to say that, right? And I got to a moment, and again, I think that this was a pivotal moment for me in my career, and personally, where I finally had to accept I did the best I could with the skills that I had at the time. Now I have new skills and I get to practice new skills and I get to lend these skills to other parents and to other educators and to the children that we have in our schools. But as far as what happened in the past, we can learn from the past. You know, but stop beating yourself up because you did the best you could with the skills you had at the time.
Okay. And a lot of people right now, they're in it. They have the young kids right now. And the, you know, your state dictates my state is something that, you know, probably resonates a lot with them. And, you know, but it's hard. Like, how can I never learned how to self-regulate or compose myself. Like, I don't know what that even looks like. All I remember growing up is that if, you know, the child had a reaction, you have a bigger reaction to scare the child out of their reaction. And so, you know, without very many models, or really any models growing up, or many models maybe even right now in our adulthood, without even maybe even a community of people who are doing the same thing, a lot of people are isolated and they're the only ones, you know, they're being told from other people that you need to, you know, spank your child, or you need to, you know, yell at them or threaten it and punish them more to get them to behave. How do they, with all of that pressure and the child, meanwhile, there's all that external stuff going on and that internal stuff going on, and then there's a child in front of us who's throwing a temper tantrum over something that we don't deem to be a big deal. You know, maybe we said no to them being able to go outside or have a piece of cake or being able to play with something that isn't safe for them, or them jumping on the couch. How do I stay composed in those moments? Like, what advice do you have to offer me to help me stay composed?
Yeah. So, you know, listening to what you were just saying, I mean, it's so familiar, you know, to many of us right there. And so definitely one thing I've learned with all of that is the first thing you've got to do is get rid of the judgment. And, you know, you think about how we were raised, how our parents raised us, and how their parents raised them. And, you know, you got to release that judgment that, you know, whenever I practice composure and I practice breathing and my state dictates your state, you're going to have people that look at you and go, aren't you going to do something about this? You know? And they don't understand that you are doing something about this, but you're doing it differently than how they've done it or how it was done to you. And I know for me, especially, you know, that was hard for me at the beginning, that, you know, what are people going to think? What is my family going to think that I'm doing this differently? Because they do kind of look at you like, what are you doing? You know? And so you got to release that judgment. And I think that's critical for a lot of people, because we live in a world where we're constantly judged right now, yeah. You know, in person, in social settings, on social media, we're constantly being judged. And that's a skill that you have to practice to be able to step away from that. And not care what other people are thinking or seeing, and you just focusing on what is the right thing to do, you know, and lending these skills to the children so that we can break the cycle, we can teach a new way. And so in 10, 20 years, we won't live in this judgmental world where we're divided between us and them. You know, and that's exactly where we're at right now. We're idling an emotional state as a world. But maybe, just maybe, the difference that we're making in these classrooms and with our children and within our families, we can break that cycle. And wouldn't that be fantastic? And that is so empowering for people to realize that the opportunity they have to make a difference in that classroom every single day, every interaction that you have with a child, you have that opportunity to set a new path. And that's pretty cool to be able to realize.
Yeah, that's powerful. But Tim, I'm still triggered. I'm still feeling this triggeredness in my body. So what do I do about that? Do I just ignore the feeling and just try to power through it? Do I take it out on the child? What do I physically do with those feelings in my body?
you know, feelings are natural, and we're all human, and we all have to realize that we're going to get triggered. And y'all, it doesn't matter how long you've been practicing this, you're still going to get triggered on a daily basis. You're going to get triggered. So, you know, recognizing those triggers, you know, remember, anytime you get triggered, you're always the last person to know. Everyone around you is going to be aware of your trigger except for yourself. So that's the key right there, is being able to recognize when you have been triggered, right? And then finding that way of calming yourself that is unique and special to you. And we all have that unique, special way of calming. You've got to find that for you, what works best for you. And accepting the fact that it's okay to have feelings. It's okay to get triggered, all right? Being able to name those feelings, that I am angry, I am stressed, I am scared, I am frustrated, I am anxious, you know? Anxiety is a big word right now, huge word right now. And there's a lot of people that are struggling with anxiety. This is a big trend in what they're calling the post-pandemic world, is the anxiety. Because, you know, the bottom has been ripped out from underneath us so many times in the last 3 years, it's very hard to be optimistic and to look forward, because we just don't know when the rug is going to be pulled out from underneath us again. So anxiety is a big word right now. It's okay to have those feelings, you know, recognize those feelings. And then be able to push through those feelings so that you can make the choice yourself to solve the problem. I've got the choice to feed off of this feeling and act like a fool, or I've got the choice of accepting these feelings and making it productive and moving forward. And we all have that choice every single moment, you know. Now, the stronger the feeling, the harder it is to make that choice. Because like you, sometimes our mouth tends to start working before we get through those steps, and we end up saying something or doing something we regret 5 minutes later.
Yeah.
You know what? That's human.
Yeah.
That's human. But that's where those natural consequences are so critical as well, that you're able to recognize that, oops, I made a mistake. I didn't handle that situation well. I can do better next time. Yeah. You know, and we hang on to that. But, you know, my word of advice for people out there, don't try to master this. You're not going to master it. It takes years. It takes a lifetime of practice. And we're going to have mistakes. We're going to have oops. That's what makes us human. All right. And you're not going to be perfect 100% of the time. But as long as I'm consciously aware of the choice that I have, and I'm consciously aware of the feelings, you're on the right track.
All right. You mentioned natural consequences. And I want to, because consequences is, it's one of the skills of conscious adults. So I want to just know very generally, like, how do you use, it's another two-part question. How do you kind of use that skill, one, with adults and with children? It's kind of like a three-part question. And, you know, I really think as consequences is one of the most difficult skills to use, because it can be so easy to kind of power trip, especially when you're in that position of power, and not use it appropriately. And so I want to know, like, how do you use, you know, what are consequences? How do you use them with adults? And how do you use them with children?
Yeah. So, you know, I think sometimes people tend to want to make consequences too dramatic. We kind of dig too deep into it. And, you know, the thing that I like to remind people of when it comes to consequences is that, you know, our brain is wired to be compassionate. We are genetically wired to be compassionate. We are also genetically wired to know the difference between right and wrong. And especially in my world where we're working with young children, 0 to 5, that compassion and that knowing the difference between right or wrong comes pretty quickly for a child, for them to be able to realize, the empathy and to be able to see the world from other people's point of view, that I did something that affected another person and I feel bad about that, or I feel sorry that I did that. That comes pretty quickly with young children. The older the child gets, the more difficult this becomes, because then society and judgment starts clouding that, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's harder for the adult to learn and accept consequences than it is for the child, in my opinion, because we're the ones that want to make this muddy and problematic, right? Mm-hmm. But it's being able to recognize that I did something, I said something that affected another individual, and having that compassion of, I wish I would have done something different. And I think that we've all been in those scenarios where we've said something or we've done something, and then you realize that it wasn't the best thing to do and you feel bad about it. Internally, you feel bad about it without anyone saying anything or provoking anything. You feel bad about what you've done or you've said. That's a natural consequence, and that's how we learn. That's the best way for us to learn, rather than it being a rule that is enforced or a punishment that is enforced. And so my advice to adults is to kind of simplify this. Don't make it so junky, right? But focus on those internal consequences of the feelings that you have about the choice that you made. And I think that we have a lot to learn from young children in this category. You know, when we talk about the 5 steps to self-regulation with young kids, it's very rare that we get to step 4 or 5. Because by the time the child recognizes that they've been triggered, by the time they calm, by the time they're able to name their feeling, the choice of solving the problem, they're like, we're done, you know? And the kid hugs or apologizes or whatever, and they move on, you know? And they learn from those experiences. And I don't think as adults we give them enough chance and opportunity to live through that before we muddy the waters. And because again, you know, growing up the way we grew up, there's got to be an external consequence. There's got to be a visible consequence. You know, there needs to be tears or blood, and that's the consequence right there. Yeah. And it's not about the external visible consequence. It's about the internal consequence, and that's the natural consequence we talk about.
Yeah. So is there anything with a natural consequence? Are you saying that when a child, let's say, hits another child or is, maybe standing on a table when, you know, you've asked them to sit in the chair, is the answer just to put your hands up and say, I guess they're going to learn from it themselves without my intervention? What is my role to play in this natural consequences? And what about logical consequences?
Yeah. Well, I mean, in both of the scenarios that you explained, you know, whether it's standing on a table or hitting a child, another child, that is just a sign of a missing skill. So, you know, the opportunity for the adult right there is to teach a new way. You know, a child can only use the skills that they've got at that time. And that's what when we're talking about missing skills or skills that people have, it's really important to focus on what skills are available to that child at that time. Just because they had the skill yesterday doesn't mean they have it at this moment. We just have to practice the new skill. Let's show them a better way so that they can see a better way of solving their problem, a better way of communicating. a more effective way of communicating or solving the problem. And then that's going to instill that natural consequence of standing on the table or punching my friend wasn't an effective way or a meaningful way of getting across what I'm trying to say or do. But it goes back to lending those skills to the child so that they can understand the difference. And they've got to be able to understand the difference or you are going to hit the brick wall, you know. And so many times, you know, get off of that table, you know better. We don't hit our friends, you know. We make the assumption that the child understands, you know, that they know better, or we're making that assumption, but we have to be willing to teach the new skill or have them see it a different way. You know, all behavior is a form of communication and all behavior is an opportunity to teach.
Yeah. I'm going to push back a little bit here, Tim. And, okay. And for the example of standing on the table, right? Let's say they, because, you know, they hit the other child gets hurt or they cry, whatever, they make the facial expression. It's easier for them to kind of see the consequence, the immediate consequence of their action in that moment. Someone got hurt and they're having a reaction. Now, standing on the table, it might just be, hey, I'm having fun. No one's getting hurt. I'm doing a little bit of risky play. I'm kind of exploring, seeing the world from a different perspective. And would you say?
I said, look at me. I'm up here. Yeah.
Right. There's nothing, you know, and at some point I jump off and I don't get hurt. It was a good time. And so there's no real natural consequence in this scenario that I just set up that the child can see, because they had a good time. No one got hurt. And they're, you know, just doing a natural thing that kids do. They like to climb and explore and do all kinds of things like that. The missing skill, they don't have a missing skill. They're practicing their climbing skills. They're practicing their gross motor skills. So, you know, what is there to, you know, what do we do about that? Do we just wait and trust that they will no longer want to stand on the table? Do we wait for other children to be like, hey, like, you're stepping on my toys? Like, what do we, in that scenario where they're just exploring, they're doing something that no one gets hurt and they don't get hurt. How do you, what's the missing skill here? What's the, you know, in terms of consequences, if you are going to, like, do natural consequences show up? Like, talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so a couple of different things on that. Of course, you know, the other thing that we need to be practicing in these scenarios is the language of safety. So using the safe words, practicing the language of safety, but that, you know, standing on the table is not safe. Our feet belong on the floor. You know, we do have a slide with steps that if you want to see the world from a higher point of view, let's climb up the steps and see it up there where there's handrails. So, of course, the ongoing language of safety is important here. And, of course, going back to child growth and development, climbing is the third way children learn to explore. So the appropriate thing to do in this situation, if you have a child climbing on a table, is to give them something appropriate to climb on. Because, you know, anyone that works in a toddler 2-year-old classroom, you know, children are going to climb. And if they don't have the appropriate equipment to climb on, they will find something themselves, which is usually a table or a chair or whatnot. Mm-hmm. So let's redirect them to the appropriate item to climb on, because they obviously need that. They've got that impulse. They want to explore. That's gross motor development. So let's flip it into a situation that's beneficial to the child.
Okay. So what I'm hearing is giving them other ways to kind of meet their needs to climb, to do the thing that they're trying to do in a safe way. And right. Also using the language of safety and talking about what is safe to do in the classroom or safe to do in that environment, whatever the environment is, whether it's a household or a classroom or maybe even a park.
Right.
Right. Right. Okay. So is there a situation, what situation, actually, okay. Another kind of two part. Well, I'm going to ask them the parts, natural consequences. How can we, is there any way for us as adults to kind of maximize the benefits of natural consequences?
Is there a way as adults for us to maximize natural consequences?
The benefits of natural consequences.
The benefit of natural consequences is that it's not something that's forced onto the child. You know, right. Tell them you're sorry. You know, we're not going outside until you tell them you're sorry. That's not going to instill a natural consequence. We're going to remember the feeling that we had with a natural consequence, much more likely than a forced consequence, mm-hmm. you know? And so that's where we want that. Now, again, you know, this isn't going to happen overnight. You're not going to be able to go back to your classroom or go back to your home and be successful at this tomorrow. You know, we start with compassion. We start with empathy. We start with being able to see the world from other people's point of view. Those skills have to be practiced first, you know, before those natural consequences kick in. And you know, even as adults, because we've talked a lot about working with adults, whether it's employees or teachers or members of the community or your own family, you know, we are struggling right now where we're a divided country, world, where we are living, you're either an us or a them, and the sense of connection is really broken, and we're dealing with a lot of willingness issues, and willingness comes from connection, but if we're not connected, we won't have compassion. And definitely throughout this pandemic, empathy is a skill that has been lost. Because we have been in survival mode for so long, the ability to have compassion for someone else or to know what someone else is feeling is a missing skill right now for adults and for children. And that's why, you know, I've really been focused for the last year and a half in almost all of the workshops that I've been doing. We've really been focused on connection. Because we have to be connected before we can have willingness. And we have to have compassion and empathy before any of that stuff takes place. Well, the compassion and empathy has to be there before natural consequences kick in. So we got a lot of work to do right now, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
We have a whole lot of work to do right now. I'm extremely optimistic that we're going to get there. The great thing is, we have the perfect opportunity working with young children to really make a difference here. Mm. And working with the families, working with the community, we are just in a prime spot to be the trendsetters and getting us back on track and getting us back where we need to be. But the willingness to be connected has got to be there first.
Mm. Yeah. And, you know, I think, and I'm thinking about what you just said, and mm-hmm. you know, you and your company, you've made the decision where it is school-wide, company-wide, conscious discipline implementation. And so, you know, everyone is, you know, practicing the skills, practicing empathy and compassion and that perspective taking. And teachers and children alike are practicing these skills. You know, I think what can make it, in a perfect world, everyone would be practicing these skills. It wouldn't just be, you know, the school family, it'd be the community family, it'd be the country family, it'd be the global family, right? In reality, that's not what's happening. A lot of schools, families, communities are more focused on fear-based approaches and strategies with very little empathy and compassion. And for children who are, especially, you know, you're talking about the, you know, 0 to 5, where they're just, they're absorbing everything. They're learning everything from their environment. And yes, they may get some from the, maybe the household. They may get some skills from the school. Maybe largely what they're experiencing in their general environment, a lot of times is fear and shame based. And, you know, how do you, in a school setting, when you have people coming from these different, you know, fear, shame-based environments, you know, how do you, you know, using a program that relies very much on the empathy and compassion and really trusting that process with children, how do you implement it? How do you implement it and practically kind of survive when you're still building that discipline within the children and also kind of fighting against these external factors? And then also, you know, knowing that they may, you have them from 0 to 5, but then they're going to go and be in a school system where it is, they're very much, you know, in a lot of states, paddling children is still a part of, yeah, it's, you know, part of the process of what they do, part of the discipline process of, you know, what they do. So how do you, I guess my, to kind of condense my question is, how do you teach these skills and kind of live and create this culture of safety and compassion and connection when and building that within children, when the fear and shame is also simultaneously being built within children at the same time?
Sure. So, you know, first off, you know, just remember the only person you can change is yourself.
Yeah.
And then when you change yourself, you influence others. And that influence is a big part of this. And your influence has to be huge. And, you know, when you walk into the school, you kind of have to walk in with the skills that I'm going to be positively contagious, and I'm going to spread this positive energy. And I'm a big energy person. You know, you feel it when you walk into a school, you feel it when you walk into a retail establishment, you mm-hmm. feel it when you walk into a home. And that energy has the power to influence people. So, but I can only focus on what I can change within myself.
Yeah.
But our hope here is that by changing ourselves and by willing to change ourselves, our influence is so strong that we can be positively contagious, that everyone that we come in contact with, our community around us, has just that little bit of hope and optimism and influence that they also can make a change. I can't change other people. I can't change other organizations. And, you know, we definitely can't change other people's point of view. They have to do that on their own.
Yeah.
But I just want to be a positive influence to everyone that we come into contact with. That's what I can focus on. And when you have an entire school that's practicing that same belief, and you've got an entire school family, you know, the administrators, the teachers, the children, the families that have that positive influence, it is amazing the impact that it can make on others.
Yes, for sure. One last question, Tim. How do you keep that flame and spark going for yourself?
Well, this is being recorded, so I can't say what I want to say.
say it.
Oh, no, yeah, no. There's always alcohol involved, right? No, just kidding. You know, it's I feed myself. I feed off other people's success. So when I see my administrators, my leaders successful, when I see my teachers successful, that really fills my bucket. and families that are successful. That right there really, really fills my bucket. And, you know, and that's an important characteristic for a leader. And this is something that I train on in my leadership trainings, is that you do have to have the ability to self-motivate. You know, as a leader, we're typically responsible for motivating others, but who motivates us, you know? And you have to find that one thing that fills your bucket, you know? And seeing other people successful, seeing children successful, fills my bucket. But then also my conscious discipline family, my early learning leaders family, my early care and education family, you know, all of these different circles of people that I work with on a daily basis, common individuals that share a common interest and common goal and a common lifestyle as me, just being around those people, that is a huge bucket filler for me. And that's what keeps me going. And, you know, when I have people ask me, why do you go to conscious discipline so much? Why do you help out so much? Why do you, you know, go to Orlando? Because that fills my bucket, you know, mm-hmm. and doing these different events and being with these people. But you got to find that one thing that works for you. For me, I love seeing other people successful.
Yeah. Yes. Other people's successes and your community is mm-hmm. what I'm hearing there. And I'm very similar in that way. Even sometimes, you know, I've been practicing conscious discipline as well. And even sometimes, you know, it can be very exhausting because you're giving so much emotional energy and you're giving and caring for so many different people. And sometimes it can be exhausting, and that those moments of reflection where, you know, you hear a child use the skill and they're successful, you know, things that come to mind right now, some very specific examples of just hearing children kind of set boundaries and use their assertive voice and saying, I don't like it when you blank, please blank. Like, that's a huge, you know, skill. And then the other person respecting the boundary even more, like, those are things that really fill me up. And even, I mean, using a lot of visuals, but even when they see, I also noticed that without my intervention, that sometimes there'll be problems that children will identify, and they'll make little visuals and they'll make little signs for things. And you know, those are the days where I really, even a day, like, I might be exhausted by the end of the day, but those are the things that I at the end of the day, it's like, yes, I can come back tomorrow. Right. Yeah. And even on the parent support side, when I'm having sessions with parents and they're coming back and it's the next week or next month, and they talk about their successes at the beginning of the sessions, like, that, again, it motivates me as well. And and I'm still building out my community, even my community through social media, of people that I have never actually met before. A lot of times fill my bucket up too. So I definitely resonate with that. Thank you so much, Tim, for coming out. Well, not coming out, for sitting there and talking with me and my community about the power of conscious discipline and natural consequences, and how to influence change in your household, in your community, in your classroom. I'm very thankful for you sharing your wisdom with us and your experience. Any last things you want to say?
No, just thank you so much for having me, and I wish everyone well, and enjoy this new year, and let's make the best of it.
What's my name? What's my name? What's my name?